Accession number 6930, roll number 2.
General Melton, reel 2. I think you were making the point that your team in Portsmouth were all air-minded.
Yes, well, as you know, I had 5 years in the Fleet Iron before World War II. My chief staff officer and my G2, his assistant, were both had distinguished records in World War II as Fleet Iron pilots, and the third member of the team we had working on it at least wore parachute rings. This was, in fact, very noticeable that my two World War II pilots could go over to Leon Sovland, which was Flag Officer Air's headquarters, and meet friends and be accepted there fully and talk with their matters about the problem of this conversion of the bulwark to a commander carrier.
What part did you play in this work of conversion?
Well, we might I speak for my headquarters as a whole, or this team as a whole. We made a thorough investigation of the problems as we saw them, and we then made on a presentation of a fictitious operation. At the time, there was some trouble in Arabia, and there had been a bit of a crisis there, and we built up a story around it of how this might have been handled by a commando carrier with helicopter-borne marines. I think really I had some very talented presenters of this, because we did a half-hour presentation, I think it was only a half-hour, may have been longer, on a cloth model, and we visited all the staff colleges. I don't think, in fact, we gave it at the Imperial Defence College. We certainly did it at Latimer, at Camberley, where the Air Force was there as well, and at Greenwich. And eventually we gave it in Whitehall, and we were attended by the First Sea Lord and the Chief of the Imperial General Staff. We met a certain amount of criticism, mainly from Camberley. Well, Nigel Poet was the comment then. He's a red beret, perhaps he was defending the parachute as a means of approach. But anyway, they said with the justification, wasn't the helicopter very vulnerable? And in fact, we had a special session with the having given our presentation. Another day, we went to argue with the directing staff at Camberley how vulnerable the helicopter was, which is, of course, everything is vulnerable to something or other, and it's not a very easy point to argue, but at least we tried to sell them this idea that the helicopter wasn't a death trap.
Was that the main or sole criticism of
you? Well, you see, we were very lucky as Marines to have access to Fleet Air Arm, because the RAF didn't like helicopters much in those days. So we really almost had a sort of private naval helicopter army, private army if you like, between the Marines and the Fleet Air Arm.
What you say, you had a presentation for based on a fictitious operation. What sort of operation was it? Was it just a swift intervention by a small?
Stop it, man. And the scene of the exercise was that there's an oasis on the borders of Oman with some oil wells in, and these were threatened as they had been a few months previously by the Saudi Arabians. And the scenario we worked out involved sending a commander by helicopters from the carrier to repossess ourselves of these oil wells.
Well, that would have meant that the helicopters would have to fly quite a distance inland.
Yeah. Well, now, in the middle of all this, really, I think we'd done most of our presentation, but we hadn't done all, because I think probably the next lot came around the second year, of course, at the Staff College, because then, of course, the a serious crisis happened. So we had to rewrite our scenario to cut out anything that might it became even more fictitious at that stage. And of course, as you know, the helicopter operation was carried out at Port Said. It was a beach landing by helicopter in Port Said. Of course, we'd been talking in terms of deep penetration, but on the other hand, they hadn't got a they had an ad hoc flight, helicopter flights, and nothing had been worked out very much by then. But certainly, that put the Port Said, of course, pushed the idea of the bulwark conversion very strongly. And by before I left Eastney, Portsmouth, the Alban was being... No, the Alban hadn't been earmarked. At one time, the Alban was going to be done first. That was changed to bulwark. But I went on board the Alban for days flying from Eastney, and was able to say that the last Alban I visited was the predecessor of pre-dreadnought when I was a boy of about five. I went to children's party.
So could I sum this up by saying that at Port Said, the helicopters were used as a substitute for landing craft, whereas your concept was to put the troops down perhaps in the enemy rear or to guard some vital point?
Yeah. Without any criticism, they hadn't the facilities. It might have been considered rather rash to have put them, go deep in. They hadn't got the troop lift, you see. This all became much more practical when we got the Wessex. We were talking, we knew about the Wessex. We were in close touch with Yeovil, Westlands, and we visited them several times, and they came and visited us. So we knew all about the Wessex was coming.
So you were planning on the Wessex as the carrier?
Yes. The bulwark was originally commissioned with Whirlwinds, of course, but the Wessex was in the pipeline by then.
How many men could you get into a Whirlwind?
Not very many, I suppose four or five. Wessex would take a commando infantry section, which made a great deal more sense of it all, about 10 or 12.
So really the Whirlwind was just a taxi cab, but the Wessex was a tactical delivery vehicle.
Yes. The Whirlwind was a primitive stopgap, really.
Was the intention behind your concept of operations that a helicopter should actually land as an assault force, or was it that they should land their troops away from the enemy and the troops would then form up on the ground and move into action?
You would try and avoid enemy with a helicopter land. I think that would still be the doctrine. You must remember that at this stage the United States Marine Corps had made a great deal of use of helicopters in Korea, and they had in fact commissioned the first LPH, the Thetis Bay, as it was called, and then the Essex class were being designated and so on. So we were following in the steps of the United States Marine Corps and the United States Navy, of course. We also consulted the French, because they'd made a great deal of use of helicopters in terms of security in North Africa, in Algeria. So they were both advances. I mean, the idea... The Fleet Arm had already landed troops in Malaya by helicopter. They'd used an anti-submarine warfare squadron, made some small landings with troops in Malaya. So we had a good... By asking the Americans and asking the French their ideas and so on, we had a good bit of background, and we had Fleet Arm pilots who had landed troops.
But you weren't planning to do helicopter assaults?
It depends what you mean by assault. I think if we use assault, strictly speaking, no, we weren't. Because I don't think anyone would if they could possibly avoid it.
Did you ever think about possibly producing a helicopter gunship or something?
Yes,
of that
it was
sort.
Mentioned. People talked about it.
Where did that idea come from? Was it the Americans or the French?
The Americans were certainly doing it, but it's a fairly natural idea, I think. If somebody's going to shoot at you, and somebody may well shoot at you or trying to get to your landing place, we may find somebody there and you didn't expect to be there, or we may have to overcome minor resistance. You obviously want to shoot back. We also sold the idea of lifting out transport. we went over to Leon Selent and we got the we got Citroën salesman. He lent us a Citroën 2CB. The whirlwind wouldn't lift the Jeep, but this brave man allowed us to lift a 2CV by whirlwind. And this is the first time I'd ever seen a vehicle angling below a helicopter. I think the first time most people have seen. And I think we even persuaded the Admiralty to buy about half a dozen 2CVs for the first commandership. I don't quite know about that. We tried hard. We said, when you commission the Bulwark, why don't we have a few of these vehicles? Because the idea that you can just plunk people down on foot without vehicles, certainly in the desert, is quite false. When I say in the desert, you must remember the Navy's main task at that stage was the provision of task forces east of Suez. And so there you had the idea of the commando ship fitting in very neatly into the idea of a carrier task force sent to east of Suez or otherwise out of the main confrontation to attach another carrier, which had once been a light fleet carrier, you see, it fitted very admirably into the whole of this concept.
Produce a balanced task force.
Well, it meant you could produce a land element. I hesitate to say balance because there was a serious lack of supporting arms. And if I might just go on ahead, the time I was, when I was became chief of amphibious warfare, we'll deal with later, I attended the first exercise, the Bulwark, in the Mediterranean. And it went very well, but there was an armored, British armored car squadron made to be the enemy for them, and I could only say, as a strict military appreciation, the armored car squadron would have won because they had mobility and longer range weapons than the Marine Commando once they were ashore.
Well, one could argue that if you put Marines ashore from helicopters beyond the range of naval guns, then they would be in exactly the same sort of position as paratroops are.
Exactly.
Just as vulnerable to anyone with heavy equipment.
Well, as a result of this exercise, I went to see the Vice Chief of the Naval Staff, who this was after Admiral Johns' death, and pointed this out. And I think I did start off the movement, which eventually led to the gunner, the Royal Artillery batteries being attached to commanders.
Now, you say that the idea was that the commando carrier should be used mainly east of Suez. What sort of operations was it?
We had a little scenario about the Oman confrontation.
So it was mainly small-scale interventions.
Small-scale intervention, yes.
What about assaults to prepare the way for infantry and armour?
Well, I think we then have to say what infantry and armour. You see, it couldn't be very formidable infantry and armour because we still only had the old amphibious warfare assault squadron.
But let's suppose perhaps there might have been a requirement to make an assault upon a Mediterranean or a European country. Could you see a role for the commando carrier in those circumstances?
Oh yes, we always envisaged acting with the if necessary with the amphibious warfare squadron, but you must remember the low speed and the low ocean going characteristics of the amphibious warfare squadron. But undoubtedly we well realise that when it comes to an emergency you use everything you've got. But we have said that we hadn't got very much in those days.
But had you been making a major invasion around the Mediterranean or in Europe, what sort of operation, what sort of part would have been played by the commando carrier?
Well, I suppose the leading role in view of what our sources were, but this is really why I disagreed very much with Fremington, the School of Amphibious Warfare, because they were talking in terms of, they were using the techniques of Overlord. And we just had nothing like the resources. And this is where I mentioned this LST captain. I said, all the things we ought to have, but it's all the things we hadn't got. Any idea of a major invasion, really, it was quite out of the question.
So you couldn't really consider it?
Well, it was remarkable what they got together for the Suez operation, but even that you could hardly call a major invasion.
Can I talk a bit about the actual ships, the Albion and the Bulwark? I think these were, in their original form, they were escort carriers.
No, they were light fleet. It's a very different proposition, a light fleet carrier.
What's the main difference?
Bigger, faster, more aeroplanes. It is a fleet fleet carrier, although only a light fleet carrier. Well, an escort carrier, well, the name tells you it. It's for escorting. There were also some things in World War II called the assault carriers. Their primary role was amphibious operations. That was to give air support to amphibious operations. But they were the same type of ship as an escort carrier. Smaller ships, very often converted merchant ship hulls, quite slow, not more than, say, about a dozen aircraft.
How many aircraft did the Albion and Bulwark have on them when they were originally?
I can't tell you from memory.
And how many men did you intend to have on?
We hoped to get a commander, and perhaps more for short periods. Undoubtedly, we wanted a commando group. In other words, we wanted supporting arms. But the idea, the commander brigade member in those post-war years had no supporting arms.
Just
breaking a principle of war, if you like, but that's what it was.
Well, it would presumably be a useful force to have politically, even if not militarily,
yes,
to show a presence.
But there's that operation with the Bulwarks, first operation showed that you were taking a big risk. You might have got rounded up without supporting arms.
How many helicopters were you intending to have on a carrier?
I think it was about 12, I'm not sure.
So you'd have to do quite a lot of trips ashore to get all the...
Oh, yes, it would, yes.
Did the...
I mean, 12 was... may have been more, but I think it was in the nature of one squadron.
Well, I would imagine that you could get more whirlwinds on them than Wessex.
Yeah, but of course you get a bigger you get a bigger lift of Wessex than it would be whirlwinds. You wouldn't get enough. You certainly wouldn't be able to lift the commando in one lift. I don't think the Bulwark and Albion could do it even with Wessex.
Presumably, with the Wessex, you could get a company ashore at a time.
Oh yes, I think more perhaps. Yes, if we get more, I think we'd get about half the commando with Wessex.
So it'd have to be two flights to get
with Wessex lift, yes.
How far away from the carrier did you envisage the maximum distance for the troops to operate?
Well, it would depend really on what the opposition was. A minimum opposition, you could use maximum range of the helicopter. But that would, against any, there might be a lot of chance to go on.
What about other means of getting ashore? Did the carriers have landing craft?
Yeah, carriers did have landing craft. Rather against my... I rather opposed them at first, but they certainly proved very useful. And we also wanted to get them a raft to lift vehicles. But I think they did have it was to be towed ashore, to get some of the vehicles ashore.
Why were you against having landing craft?
Well, I frankly thought that you'd be operating too far away from shore with the range of the helicopters. It seemed to me they're too... But I was wrong about that, no doubt about it.
So the idea then, your idea was that the carrier could stand off even further away,
yeah,
from any enemy guns.
Yes. I certainly wouldn't bring a carrier in range of enemy coast artillery.
Did the carrier have any defensive armament?
Anti-aircraft defenses only.
Mm-hmm. What did you have for anti-aircraft defense?
I can't give the details. It could be looked up from Jane's writing scripts and things like that. Incidentally, we get an accurate number of, for the lift, the number of aircraft from Jane's writing scripts. When I became chief amphibious officer, to my horror, I found that they were proposing to put these landing craft on davits above the level of the flight deck. But I think anyone who'd ever left landing an airplane knows that obstruction on the flight deck is very dangerous indeed. And I was rather opposed by the Commandant General when I. The borderline of our responsibilities wasn't very clearly defined on this, and I used my position as Minister of Defence to take this point up. Now, luckily, Admiral Henry Rolfe was what was known as Deputy Chief of Naval Staff Weapons, and we had been in the same flying course together and been shipmates in my first carrier. And Henry Rolfe, of course, once saw the knowing being a much more modern aviator by then than I was, you can't do this. And so we at least managed to get the davits for the LCAs below the level of the flight deck, after which, of course, my opposition to them went. As I must say, originally I wasn't very taken with the idea of the landing craft at all.
When were the Royal Canal being actually converted? When were they actually converted to their new role?
The Bulwark was commissioned, I suppose, about 1958. We could look that up again. James Whiting ships to give away.
Did it involve very major structural changes?
It involved a very considerable refit. It was in dockyard hands, I think, about a year. I think they removed the catapult there. They increased the troop spaces and things like that.
I believe that in 1957 you were sent to the Ministry of Defence.
Yes, I completed my 3-year tour, for more than 3 years, as Major General Royal Marines Portsmouth, and I was appointed to take over as Chief of Amphibious Warfare. This was an appointment which in some way was a relic of World War II, where Combined Operations Headquarters had been a very large organisation, a very important one, a very successful one. At the end of the war, the idea of abolishing it entirely obviously was too big a decision to take. The name was changed, and that was quite a logical change to the name. The Americans used the term amphibious warfare, where we'd use the term combined operations, and amphibious warfare is a more accurate term. Wildman Lushington was a Marine general who had served on Mountbatten's staff quite a lot, both at Combined Operations and in SEAC, and he was appointed as Chief of Amphibious Warfare in about 1948. He was relieved by another Marine after 3 years, General Thomas, and I think General Thomas probably should be given credit for the formation of the Amphibious Warfare Squadron, which I talked about, which, with all its limitations, was an important stopgap. And then my predecessors, Major General Royal Marines Portsmouth, General Phillips, became Chief of Amphibious Warfare, and I then stepped into his shoes 3 years after that.
When you arrived at the Ministry of Defence, were you given a brief as to what you should do?
I don't think anyone told me anything about what I should do.
You were just told you were in charge of all amphibious warfare.
Yes, I cannot remember if I had a written brief of what my responsibilities were, but certainly nothing about policy.
Who did you have to report to?
The Chief of Defence Staff.
Direct.
Obviously through his deputies and so on, if necessary, but with access to the chief. You don't go to the chief on small matters, of course.
This puts you on the same sort of level in some ways as the chief of general staff and the...
No, that would be wrong. Ron Mountbatten was chief of combined operations, which was, he was made, I think, about 6 months after he became... the original was Commodore Combined Operations, I think, and then he went up to Vice Admiral. He was then a member of the Chiefs of Staff Committee with full rights. But that the Chief Amphibious Warfare was never that. I'm not certain if Laycock was that when he took over from Mountbatten, but certainly in the post-war era, the Chief Amphibious Warfare was one of the advisors of the Chiefs of Staff. He was consulted on amphibious warfare matters. And he would approach them, if necessary, on amphibious warfare matters. And one got the minutes of the Chief of Staff, but you were not, so to speak, a voting member or anything like that. You had the ear of the Chief of Staff, but you certainly were not a decision-making person.
Were there any other senior officers with the same sort of rather ambiguous position that you had?
I don't think there were, actually. I mean... people of the two-star level and above were often called in on their subjects. But speaking from memory, I can't think of anyone who's quite the same position as the Chief of Amphibious Warfare. Not that gave him any more privilege.
Who did you have under your command?
I had a naval captain, Captain R.N., as my chief staff officer. And at the next level below, I had two Army Lieutenant Colonels, a Marine Lieutenant Colonel, I think. The weakest point, and one or two other, obviously, a suitable array of more junior. It wasn't a big headquarters. I had a Naval Secretary, Lieutenant Commander of the Supply and Secretarial Branch, and I had an personal assistant, and I think my staff, the clerical staff, were largely Wrens, I think.
So it was really very mixed.
It was very mixed, and one of the things I found necessary and did, well, are two things. The first thing was our senior airman was a squadron leader, and I made an approach to the vice chief of the air staff. And said, look, I think you should have something. I should have someone more senior. And I got a wing commander, and that made a lot of difference. The other thing I found necessary, or it's a good thing, was I tried to get each of my, certainly the lieutenant colonel's level, and all through, to go and visit the headquarters of the other services, certainly the War Office Admiralty Exchange. I suppose by chance I'd seen something of the War Office during the war, and I had a tour as Colonel G.S., which was a